from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Bay Area writer and artist Jenny O'Dell worries that all of the things competing for our attention, from social media to a 24/7 work ethic, are preventing us from connecting with the very things that we need in order to thrive.
I'm trying to push back against what we think productivity is and kind of ask the question, you know, productive of what and for whom and why.
Engaging with others and with the environment, allowing our brains to run free and speculate, these activities are losing out to materialism and gazing at Instagram feeds. Coming up, Jenny O'Dell joins us to talk about her book, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. And that's next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. From the grind of the gig economy to the hustle for likes on social media, there's always something to do and a constant pressure to do it. The best way to resist the productivity pressures of our tech capital is to do nothing, says Bay Area artist and writer Jenny O'Dell. And in her book, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy, she champions resisting the lure of online commerce and social media and taking more time to experience our immediate environments. Jenny O'Dell joins us here in studio to discuss her book. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Delighted to have you. And let's take a little time here to find out what your thesis is. It's not just, moving away from the computer, obviously, or your iPhone or any of those gadgets. It's a lot more than that.
Right. I think, that might be one step of the way. But I think what I'm talking about is not so much walking away from something, but walking towards something else, maybe. And for me, that just happens to be the local ecology as well as, local history. But I think, there's plenty of writing right now about putting down your phone and having less screen time that doesn't really address what else you would direct your attention toward.
Like with you, it was a rose garden, right?
Yes.
Watching birds.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. A lot of this came from a moment that I kind of had in late 2016 after the election and after the ghost ship fire in Oakland, when I was feeling sort of paralyzed. And I happened to live near the Rose Garden off of Grand Ave in Oakland. And I found myself going there pretty much any time that I could get over there and just sitting and sometimes reading, but oftentimes just processing. And it struck me how much our culture is arrayed against, such non-activities as sitting and thinking and processing.
Well, I think it was Democritus who said nothing means more than nothing. And when you're talking about nothing, you're not talking about nihilism or anything like that. You're talking about just going to smell the roses and appreciate what's out there. But I think beyond that, as I read your book, it all has to do with resting and maintenance and observation and thoughtfulness. And especially when you talk as an artist, you're talking about you used the word processing before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's something that I, as an artist, a practicing artist, but also someone who teaches art at Stanford, I am kind of used to being in the position of having to argue for the value of art, to my students who often are non-humanities majors, and just, to people in general, right? It's really easy to write off something like art or poetry as something that's kind of frivolous, that, doesn't kind of have results that you could point to, like deliverables, at the end of the day. And so I, even before that kind of moment of going to the Rose Garden, I think I was prepared for thinking about this just by being in that position of having to defend the quote unquote use of something like art.
Well, you've come to a place where that sort of defense is very welcome, but also it's welcome to hear somebody who is concerned about what a cult of productivity, really. That's what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah. I think one of the questions that I ask in the book that I still think about all the time is, when you say productivity, what is it productive of and why? And I think it's really easy to get caught up in something that feels very absorbing, whether that is this cult of productivity or a 24-hour news cycle or just being on social media all the time. It gets harder and harder to step away from that and ask these kind of broader questions of why why you're there in the first place, what it is that you're seeking there. Like, is this making you happy? Is this useful? You know, it's so easy now to just not have the opportunity to ask that question.
This is self-reflexiveness, isn't it, to a great extent? But it's also being more, as you said earlier, mindful of what's outside of you, making real connections with people as opposed to just online.
Yeah. I mean, I one of the things I really love about the Rose Garden is it's probably the place where I've talked to more strangers than anywhere else. I now at this point know several of the gardeners and a cat that happens to, it doesn't technically live in the
Rose Garden. You talk to a cat online?
No, in the Rose Garden. Oh. Yeah, you know, so it's just I love the Rose Garden as, you know, not only an illustration of a contemplative space, but also a space of encounter and a space where you go to kind of get outside of yourself.
And you get into some political realms here as well. And we want to talk about that because a lot of people think, oh, if you're just writing poetry or making art, you're not being political. But this is a kind of resistance in your judgment.
Yeah, I think that some of, you know, some aspects of making art, but also spending time with art. And, you know, I talk a lot about conceptual art in the book. You know, they lead to this kind of ability to pay a different kind of attention. I think that artists spend a lot of time thinking about attention and how to direct attention for the viewer. And, you know, I often think about how different something like a piece of conceptual art, let's say like a John Cage piece, which is very much encouraging the listener to be open to ambient sounds and to listen to sounds as music. How different something like that is from a clickbait headline.
There's a quote of John Cage's in your book. I think it's in that chapter where you write about Bart Libby, the Scrivener, who said, I prefer not to. May have been catatonic, but that's a whole other discussion. Could you give us that John Cage quote? I kind of liked it.
Oh, you know, it's funny. I don't actually remember.
Right, I have the book.
It's the you know, if something is boring, do it for 5 minutes and...
And then just extend it for 10 minutes or 15 minutes. I mean, basically, that's the...
Eventually, you find it is not boring at all, which is a Zen saying, actually, that he's quoting. But yeah, I think that that is very different, right, than this kind of knee-jerk reaction that you're often kind of invited to have online. And so I do think that that, you know, has an effect on how you deal with other information and other conversations, is having that kind of deepened attention.
And let's talk about deepening attention, particularly in light of boredom. And so many people are really afraid they're going to be bored, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure. I'm not even sure what boredom means anymore.
I just read a great essay on it. And it was actually an essay that was advocating boredom, that said boredom is a good thing.
I mean, I would tend to agree, but I think, you know, some of it is maybe a fear of boredom and this feeling that you know, this fear of wasting time, like time is this product and you need to squeeze
time
all
is money.
The, yeah, right. But like, it's like time has become more literally money now than it sort of has ever been, especially for someone who's working in something like the gig economy. But I think also people, and I'm, you know, I say people, I have observed that for me, it's also this difficulty of sitting with really deeply uncomfortable emotions about what is happening right now. And I think sometimes we feel like we would rather look at or think about anything other than that, even when it's more headlines that create more anxiety.
Well, some of this can lead to some serious meditation, can lead to spiritual awakening or enlightenment, can't it?
I think so. But like I said, you know, I'm very careful in the book to distinguish between checking out altogether and rather, you know, I think I'm arguing more for this pattern of checking out at times or even just mentally checking out, taking an outside perspective on something without leaving the situation, like retaining one's responsibility to what is happening, even though that is very, you know, frightening and painful right now.
Well, you're also careful to say this is not a how-to book, but I think what you're talking about, if I may say so, is kind of preserving what we call, I won't get into theological or philosophical arguments here because, you know, there are people who say there is no such thing as a soul, but what most people think of even metaphorically as a soul, preserving and cherishing your soul as opposed to all the pressures and stresses that come upon it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. You know, to come back to the Rose Garden, if you go there, especially right now, it's the summer, it's so beautiful. If you had to somehow report on the value of that park, like in numbers or something, right? Like, or how much productivity is this park producing? Or like, is going to this park making people more productive? Like, if you tried to reduce it to any of these, it would not appear to be a very valuable space. And yet you ask anyone who goes there, you just simply go there yourself. And it's so, you know, it's like a healing place to be. I mean, you can just see it on people's faces or by talking to them. And I think like that's sort of what I'm arguing for.
Works with in different ways with different people. When I look at waves coming in, for example, when I look at the sea or the ocean, for example, I get that feeling. Something is heightened. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be joyous. It's just something that you're kind of immersing yourself into in the moment. And it's important to be in that moment.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's sort of a reminder of the fact that you're alive. And I know that sounds sort of like woo-woo or whatever, but I think it's pretty easy to feel at times like you're living the same day over and over again, or that you just live in this horrible dystopia and you're just kind of going through the motions. And I really value these moments in which I remember that I am basically, you know, I'm an animal that's alive on a giant rock.
That's very good. There's also a lot of bifurcation in your work. I mean, you talk about your own biracial identity, and you talk about the fact that we're kind of navigating between the tech world and the world we want to create for ourselves or the world we live in. But we live in a very cocoon world here. And if you're online a lot of the time, you're not only missing the smell of the roses, you're missing essentially a lot of serious human connection, because so much is virtual.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm always struck by how different it feels to communicate directly with someone or a small group of people versus what I would call shouting into the void. And I mean, I'll be clear, I'm on Twitter. I use Twitter. But I think that there is a very big difference between the types of things that you can communicate in different scenarios. And, you know, I've been trying to go to more, you know, events and lectures in person that are related to causes that I find important in the Bay Area. And, you know, sometimes before I go, I'm like, I'm really busy. Do I really need to go to this? Or can I just read this person's book? Or can I just, you know, watch a video of it later or something? And every time I go and I show up, I'm like, this is so different. It's about sitting in the room with other bodies and seeing that other people thought this was important enough to take time out of their day and be there.
Attention must be paid. That keeps going through my head. Those are the words of Linda Lohman, the wife of Willie Lohman in Death of a Salesman. She means to other people, but she means to her husband, to people who deserve our attention. And too much attention is not given to the things that we perhaps should avail ourselves of. We're talking to Jenny Odell, author of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. She teaches at Stanford and has been an artist in residence at places such as Facebook, the Internet Archive, and the San Francisco Dump. And her writing has appeared in the New York Times, McSweeney's, the Sierra Magazine. It seems paradoxical. You're talking about doing nothing and, you know, yes, you're on Twitter and so forth, but artist in residence for Facebook? Facebook's part of the problem, maybe, not the solution.
I mean, yeah, that it was an interesting time to be there. Also, I was there in 2016. But, you know, speaking of this process of observation, one thing that I really appreciated doing while I was there was just, and I didn't really do anything with this, but I just would sit basically in this part of the campus and observe people. And one of the things that you observe when you do that in a place like that is that you are the only person doing that. It's now kind of an assignment that I give to my students to do at Stanford, is to just go and observe how people interact, specifically with their devices, with laptops and phones, but really anything.
You can learn so much just from sitting on a bench and watching people.
I mean, yeah, and I think that that's incredibly absorbing. But, you know, one tension that you have in any artist residency program is like, you know, at the end of the day, they want you to produce something. So even there in that situation, it's often hard to make this argument for the importance, the argument that observing is doing something.
Well, talk about, though, this from a practical standpoint. I mean, I can hear some resistance from listeners who say, well, you know, if you have the time or if you have the money, but I have to work. I mean, you can hear that kind of almost right. Chanting in my head. I have to work constantly to just put food on the table to just get by and so forth to pay the rent. And therefore, it sounds more like leisure activity to me. I mean, you must get some of that.
Oh, absolutely.
You?
Yeah. And I think that that's an entirely warranted response. That is one of the reasons that in, I think, chapter 3, which is called Anatomy of Refusal, after talking about various art projects where an individual is kind of embodying refusal, it's really important to me to move over to examples of things like the general strike in 1934. And I also talk earlier in the book about the fight for the 8-hour workday. And so I do, you know, have to acknowledge that any kind of refusal requires a kind of margin in which to do that. And, you know, if you, let's say you're not in a union, right, like you don't have the same margin as someone who does, you know, is in some sort of collective situation and has protection, like an individualized gig worker has almost no protection. And it's very hard for them to reach out and form networks of support. And so they're going to get very kind of crushed by this time is money mentality. And it's very important to me to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I think it is important to acknowledge. And again, we're talking to Jenny O'Dell. Let me invite calls here. Some of you may want to talk about doing nothing. You also may want to talk about how this effect of resisting the attention economy, what sort of effect it has on you and how it resonates with you. And let me give you an opportunity to join the conversation. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now at that number. How do you resist the pressure to be constantly productive and plugged in? We'll hear perhaps from some listeners who have some good tips to add, and we welcome your calls. Again, the number is 866, that's toll-free, 733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org, or you don't even have to do those things. You can just do nothing and observe and think and look at the walls and so forth, but we do involve welcome your involvement. So you're also at a dump, and I say something about your art here, because kind of, at one point, I think you said, I just put things on shelves.
Yeah. I mean, that is a very good description of what I do. And I will say that the actual name of that place is Recology SF. And I'm sure maybe some listeners are familiar with Recology.
You do take stuff from the dump, though, right?
Yes. It's the public disposal area. So it's sort of an area where, people are decluttering, things are, going out of business. And so there's basically this giant pile of stuff that changes, every hour. And my project was not to necessarily make anything out of that material, but rather to spend, 3 months monomaniacally researching the manufacturing origins and every last detail about 200 objects, which is a very Jenny thing to do. And at the end of that, I just really wanted to recreate that feeling of discovery for the viewer and present all of this information that I had found, because every object was very interesting. And so I just put them on shelves.
Remember how I said you're so binary? I mean, here again, you're operating. I mean, the work, a lot of it looks almost surreal to me, but you're operating between what we would call the real world and the digital world.
Yeah, definitely. I think that project was a good example of that, where, each object had a tag that someone could scan with their phone and read all of the information that I'd found. Let's say, watch the YouTube video of the original commercial or see Street View of the factory. Of course, I had a printed version for people who did not want to use their phones. But yeah, someone at that opening basically asked me if I actually made anything or do I just put things on shelves. And I really actually love that characterization of my work.
You're also trying to reconnect with the environment and be more mindful of, I use the word mindful particularly here, of the environment and ecology. I mean, to take the time to really interact with the environment, to commune with the environment, if you will, can not only enhance your aesthetic sense, but it can do a great deal for your sensibility, so to speak, and your politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that a big part of this book is almost like a story of me discovering what bioregionalism is.
I was tempted to bring that up because some of us get nostalgic when we hear bioregionalism.
Yeah.
It takes us back to the 70s, but you do. Yeah, go ahead with that.
I actually met someone who worked with Peter Berg
at
one
really?
Of my
yeah.
book events. Yeah. So that's been a really amazing kind of journey for me, just because I'm from the Bay Area. And so, I'm not just learning about what bioregionalism is, which is just, simply an awareness of one's ecological, sort of like your ecological address, the sort of watersheds and different systems around you and what is endemic to where you live.
Yeah, Peter would not even give his address. He would say...
Oh, right. He had that long... Well, he had a sort of address that ends on planet Earth, right? But
yeah.
It starts with the, the watershed.
And with the rock, yeah.
Yeah, right. So I was learning about that way of thinking, but I was also just simply learning about my bioregion for the first time, which is, kind of crazy because, like I said, I'm from here. And so there is a part of the book where I talk about kind of rediscovering Calabasas Creek, which is a creek that goes through Cupertino, and in a sort of surreal detail is that it goes through the Apple campus.
Yeah, Cupertino is, well, your origins are in Cupertino, but you're living in Oakland now.
Yeah.
Let's hear from some of our listeners. Again, Jenny O'Dell is our guest, and her book is How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Let's hear from Jennifer. Jennifer, join us.
Hey, I'm super touched by this conversation. It makes me emotional. I want to think about how I can incorporate, like, slowing down and literally stopping to smell the roses in my life. I mean, there's two rose gardens close to me. I don't cook from scratch enough. I've got four kids. I have the day off. I'm cooking today. But, like, hearing this, I feel like it reminds me of my grandparents, like 100 years ago, who founded a nature preserve, opened a swimming hole, like, you know, took my dad on hikes, gave me my love of outdoors through my dad and my uncles. And it's just, I feel like there's something, I don't know, so important, like, to slow down and to be in life more. And I just wanted to add, I don't really have social media. One of my daughters does, the other one doesn't, and the one who doesn't is much happier.
You know, hearing you, Jennifer, and let me go to you on this, Jenny, there's a metaphor in my mind that always works. I think of my mother hanging clothes on the clothesline. I mean, that really dates me to a great extent, but suddenly she would do a lot of thinking while she would do something like that, and a lot of these kind of menial tasks aren't there for a lot of people because they've got machines.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely true, and then I think on the other hand, you know, one of the things I mentioned in the book is the artist Mireille Lederman-Ukulis, who has been an artist in residence with the New York Sanitation Department for a really long time. And she wrote a piece called The Maintenance Manifesto. And it is about basically, you know, recognizing the value in something like maintenance and care and types of work that for a long time were, you know, free and sort of hidden in the domestic realm. And that these forms of work are not only still undervalued, but they are the kinds of work that make everything else possible. And so, I go to the Rose Garden a lot and I notice how many volunteers there are just doing the work day after day to make this space available that so many people appreciate. I mean, I've seen people walk up to gardeners and just say, thank you, you know, and I really love that attitude. And at the same time, you can see that they enjoy doing that work. And personally, like, I really love folding socks. It's something that I love to do.
Everybody has something like that, don't they? I mean, just doing something, like I said, around the house can be a way to think in a different vein and give yourself the time to think as you just do it almost automatically. Let me thank Jennifer for that call. And let me go to a comment from a listener named John who says, a way of relaxing awareness for me is to go to a quiet spot, close my eyes, and listen to the sounds around me. There are all sorts of sounds I never hear unless I intentionally listen for them. Jenny?
That's so beautiful. That's basically the John Cage piece that I mentioned, right, where you're asked to sit and listen to all the ambient sounds in the room. And I talk about in the book about how it was a John Cage piece that taught me how to actually hear sounds.
Yeah, and that's that John Cage quote. We've got it now. If something is boring after 2 minutes, try it for four. If still boring, then eight. Yep. And we'll talk more with Jenny O'Dell. We'll take more of your calls. Please feel free to join us. Toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can give us a call or you can get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. Join the program. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Jenny O'Dell. She's here with us in studio, and she's the author of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. I should mention she'll be at Moe's Books in Berkeley on August 6th at 7 p.m. But now she's here to respond to some of your thoughts as well as some of mine. And here's Lori, who writes, I find that the amount of information coming in is increasing every day, and I think people are not built for the increased speed and amount of information coming at us. I intentionally try to control the input to maintain my sanity, but it's difficult. Thoughts, Jenny O'Dell?
I mean, that's a great point and something that I personally also struggle with. I really want to recommend this article from The Guardian called How the News Overtook Reality. just because I think it's this perfect articulation of this problem. It's particularly the idea that humans were not built for this kind of amount of information. And
our producer Tina seemed to like that article a great deal.
Oh yeah, right. I mean, it just puts it into words so well, and it addresses also that guilt that you feel, right? Like we have this idea that to be the most responsible citizen, you need to be extremely up on the news. But what happens when you have a 24-hour news cycle, not to mention traffic-driven journalism, you know, that I have, you know, many friends who are freelance writers who have experienced that from the writing side, where you have to put out a certain amount of content and get a certain amount of clicks. And so on the other end of that, you have the reader, you know, the poor reader. Sure. I think, you know, all you really can do at this point is try to be intentional about it. But it's really unfortunate it has to be such a challenge for us.
Well, we've posted that article on our website, so you can indeed avail yourself of it there. And there's a little bit of subversiveness in your writing, if I may say so. I mean, you say some things that are critical of capitalism, and capitalism seems to me, particularly the competitive nature of capitalism, because you hear people say, time is money, and you hear people say, I have to work hard all the time because well, that's a competition. I'm always feeling somebody coming up behind me or that sort of thing. I mean, it really is a part of our free enterprise system. It's built into it.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, a really big inspiration that I took from reading about the 1934 general strike was that before 1933, because legislation was passed that year to guarantee the right to be part of a trade union and collectively bargain. The descriptions I was reading of longshoremen in San Francisco, sounded oddly familiar, where it was like, you know, you show up for work and it's just sort of like, maybe you get a shift that's 3 hours, maybe you get a shift that's 20 hours, maybe you don't get hired at all. The gang bosses are very nepotistic and, you know, may or may not hire you for whatever reason. And then once you're aboard, it's like everything is moving so quickly that there is lots of, you know, high rate of injury and risk, and you're just like, pressed to work harder and harder and faster.
But I think that's still with us,
right,
don't you?
Exactly.
I mean, in fact, that's really a strong point in your book. There are people who say, I can only get 2-3 hours sleep a night. What are they doing to their bodies, you know, because I have to keep up with the stuff and all that sort of thing. I have to be productive.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, to go back to that example, it was so important that they were able to unionize in the way that they did, because before that, I mean, there are, you know, actual quotes that I found, you know, that are in the book where people would say, you know, things that sound very familiar, like, if I don't do it, someone else will. We all acknowledge that this is inhumane. However, if I'm an isolated unit, I can't really resist this in a meaningful way.
And we'll not resist any more of your calls. Let me go to Lars next. Lars, join us. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Michael and Jenny. I was privileged to live and work at Esalen Institute from about 2008 to about 2016, rather.
I might have met you there.
Yeah, I think we probably crossed paths there. So I noticed a lot of people. I had the privilege of being able to observe people tuned out from media. And when election time came around, people wouldn't register to vote for the most part. There wasn't a huge knowledge. There would be people who would get a mass of audience who believed that such things, that Obama would be assassinated on election day if he was elected. Now, we are living in an age of surveillance capitalism where these unconscious leaders, Zuckerberg, Dorsey, and the like, have designed their products to be addictive. So resisting their products is pretty tricky, but calling them out for what they are, which is preying on our limbic weaknesses of by using cognitive distortions, perfectionism, all-or-nothing thinking, calling these leaders out for being unconscious leaders is what is needed now, because they're the ones who've installed autocrats and dictators and authoritarian systems everywhere.
Jenny O'Dell, some thoughts in reaction to what you heard Lars say.
I definitely think that there needs to be, and there is, I am seeing, you know, pretty, you know, specific criticism of persuasive design in particular. So one of the things that I cite in the book that was very helpful for me was a thesis that came out of Stanford that was just basically a rundown of persuasive design, you know, which goes into all the way back into just the history of advertising and the ways in which human behavior and weaknesses have been studied in order to exploit them. And there's a really amazing kind of index in the end of that thesis that is just using LinkedIn as an example. And it goes through and lists all of the different examples and elements of persuasive design, like the little, you know, little red circle, the pop-up, the, you know, all of these things that you're vaguely aware of. But when someone actually points them out to you and you start to think about how there are teams of people who are employed in designing these things that are very specifically
designing to manipulate you, essentially.
Yeah. For financial gain. Right?
Exactly. Like, and we've done whole programs on so many of those, and there are too many to count, and they are influencing people online every day. Let me thank Lars for the call, and we'll go to some more of your callers. Let me go next to a caller in the city. Eric, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Appreciate you taking the call. And Jenny, much appreciated it, and a lot of gratitude towards you for bringing this to the forefront of our attention. My question is for you, Jenny, whether you have any specific experiences or thoughts on corporate entities trying to counter this expectation of a 24/7 online work culture, and if you don't have experience with it, what you think corporate entities could do to help counter that?
Good corporate citizenship. Yeah, Jenny O'Dell.
I'm not sure if that means like for the employees.
Yeah, I think he's talking about employees. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a little bit difficult for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, I give this example in the book of I worked at a corporation many years ago that had something called the results-only work environment, or RO for short. And it was supposed to be in theory that there is no 9-to-5 and that you can do your work whenever and wherever as long as you get it done. No one cares. Of course, you know, culturally in a company, that's a little bit easier said than done. But I write that at the time I thought that was, you know, that'd be great, especially for someone, let's say, with kids or who needs a flexible schedule. But it also means, you know, if you have a phone with email, it means that you could be potentially working at any time. So I think a lot about this idea of availability, like when are you available? And in that situation, you're always available.
Well, the big tech companies have made it simply de rigueur to work all the time. I mean, you can eat there, you can have your dry cleaning done. You can bring your animals and so forth.
Get your dinner, eat it on the shuttle.
This is all done essentially to keep you working. Isn't it?
Yeah, right. So I actually, my answer is that I don't have a good example. And I think that when I try to imagine one, it would be, you know, a company that, offers benefits to its employees and also is very clear about when they are not at work.
Well, there are companies who've experimented with, and there's still some that do, with time, what you're talking about, time to think and think out of the box and all that sort of thing, which I think has a lot to be said for it. Can you talk about burnout, though? I mean, you write about it, and it's a big problem because most people don't like their jobs. I mean, polls show over and over again, a lot of people just don't like where they work or the work that they do.
Right. I think I quote Barbara Ehrenreich and Nickel and Dime as calling it repetitive stress injury of the soul. I don't know if that was the exact phrase, but
it's good.
And I'm very privileged, of course, in many ways, and one of which is that I like my job because I like teaching art to students. I think it only makes it more important, you know, to go back to what I just said, to have to be insistent about a part of your life and a part of your personhood that is yours. Something that really troubles me, and I experienced like a little bit of it when I was working at that company, certainly not as much as you would at some others, but this idea that you need to bring your whole self to work and that somehow work defines you, and that's of a piece with the idea that you would be available all the time. And, I'm so inspired by the 8-hour workday movement in that it was so adamant, right? It was like 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep, and eight hours for what we will. And in the kind of block cut graphic for that campaign, what we will is two people sitting in a boat reading a union newspaper. So,
and let's bring David into this. David, join us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Jenny and Michael. I'm finding this fascinating. I'm a poet up here in Sonoma County and a playwright, so I do some inward work for that, but also I worked in advertising for many years, so I've seen the world from both sides. And my thought is that so much of the value, Jenny, of what you write about gives us the ability to go inward to whatever extent we can. And this actually prevents us from being manipulated, because the more hyper-politics we're exposed to and extreme materialism, people will want to define us. to their advantage, not our own. So if we can define ourselves at a deeper level, I think we're on much more solid ground.
Well, thank you for those thoughts. Jenny O'Dell?
I think that's actually, you know, very related to, and I love that comment. It's related to something that I talk about kind of in the middle of the book in terms of, you know, I try to imagine what would happen if you followed or consumed all of the things that were algorithmically recommended to you over time. And I sort of, you know, like all of the movies that are algorithmically recommended to you, all the people that, you know, you may be friends with, you may like this, you may like this. And I wager that it would sort of entomb you in this very static version of the self, a sort of personal brand. And that incidentally, that's much easier to advertise to than a more kind of unpredictable or shape-shifting personality. And I contrast something like Spotify Discover Weekly, which is, you know, a playlist that's based on things that you have listened to in the past, which, you know, it's great. I listen to it sometimes, but it's very different than listening to the radio, which is what I listen to in the car, and being surprised by a piece of music, which means not only that I don't know 100% of what I like, but it also means I don't 100% know myself.
In fact, a listener called in about Spotify and registered some concerns about the fact that if you simply follow all those recommendations that come to you because of your supposed taste or brand of music that you like, you're not going to sample any other brands of music. You're just going to stay within that ghetto, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, it's happened to me where I will hear something on a, you know, community radio station and I'm just like, what is this? And why am I obsessed with it?
Let's go to some more calls. Jenny O'Dell with us, and so is Sammy. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning, Michael and Jenny. My story is the one that I have always been a type A person, had to really keep going, and I was on high blood pressure medication, and then I had a severe back injury, and I now realize that it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. I pulled out a chair and back in our little property, and I put up Raj helped me put up bird feeders, and I sat very, very quietly, rain or shine, and watched as the little birds came, and this incredible thing happened to me that as I enjoyed this beautiful part of nature that I'd never just sat and done this before, and I lowered my blood pressure down to zero, you know, down to the best blood pressure you can get. And I've never been happier in my life, and I'm 83 years old. So this is really shows that when really take this moment in time and don't get rid of those stupid cell phones and the computers and this constant stuff that has been put in our life that it's really brought us down to a very, very low level. Just go and be grateful for your eyes and ears. And I have been so quiet out there that even a Cooper's hawk landed in my lap one day.
Wow.
So this, you know, the joy that really is in, that is in this outside world that we never go to. And listen and hear. I have so much to say, but I know that
it makes you want to keep the planet preserved, though, too, in many instances. And Sammy, thank you for that. Stay healthy and good to hear from you. And it's a good way to segue to talk a little bit about bird watching here, which some people speak a little bit like, oh, watch birds, what's that all about? But the truth is, it can be very satisfying, and it is for you, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm totally jealous about the Cooper's hawk. I did just see some juvenile Cooper's hawks in the Mountain View Cemetery, which is in Oakland, and was, you know, I probably stood there for half an hour. Because, you know, the thing with bird watching is you don't know when you're going to see them again, right? And I often say that bird watching is the opposite of looking something up on Google, because if you look up something on Google, it's you either get the answer or you don't, and then you're done. And bird watching is like, if you go out bird watching, you may not see anything. You may see something that you weren't expecting. And even when you do see something, you don't know how long it's going to be there. And I've never been disappointed. I've only ever been grateful. You know, it feels like some sort of visitation or something, like regardless of what kind of bird it is.
I have a friend of a friend who just published a book about birds. He happens to be very affluent, so he could afford to go to all kinds of places and take photos of birds that you normally don't see. I mean, he was after shots of rare birds and everything. It's extraordinary. The book, I mean, in terms of what's captured there, in flight in many instances, of course. Tia writes, the guest thesis really resonated with me. The past couple of years of my life have been chaotic and stressful due to Trump's election, unemployment, and isolation. And I found myself escaping to social media, but feeling even worse. I've recently cut myself off from social media, but it's been hard to sit there and face my feelings without having a plan to redirect my time and energy. I live right next to the Rose Garden, so I'm pledging to go there 1 to 2 times a week and return to my love of reading. Good advice you gave to yourself, Tia, and thanks for that. Here's Helen, who says, wondering if Jenny follows French artist Sophie, is it Calais, a famous list maker and worshiper of common everyday objects, and I love folding clothes and hanging laundry in the sun. Such a small pleasure in my life. Do you know that artist?
Not very well, but I'm a bit familiar with her, yeah.
And actually, here's a question about art from a listener named Rick, who says, does your guest suggest engaging with your environment by making art about it, like drawing what's in front of you? I find that doing contour drawing, where you don't look up from the subject as you draw, puts me in a very calm, focused state.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I think that drawing is just, you know, one way of, you know, paying this kind of, I hate to use almost the word, the phrase paying attention, because it already is like attention is currency. But I think that something like drawing, or for me, you know, often I will sit and just write down everything that happens somewhere. These are all practices of, you know, not only observing, but trying, making a little bit of an effort to have your observation be even more granular and detailed. You know, it's also helpful if you're someone who feels like you need to still be doing something. You know, like if just sitting there is not enough, then giving yourself the kind of like tiny project of just writing down, you know, all the sounds that you're hearing or things that are overheard can be a sort of way of getting some traction there.
Yeah. In fact, listen to what Jim has to say. He says, I retired in October of last year. I live in Alameda. And since I retired, I have made it a point to walk down to the bay and sit and contemplate for at least an hour a day. Doing so has had profoundly positive effects on my overall well-being and set off a veritable flood of creativity. I don't know if this speaks more of the value to the value of doing nothing or to the evils of gainful employment.
Probably both.
We'll bring another caller aboard here. Jamie, Alexis, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for such a lively conversation. I wanted to note, in terms of thinking about that space, I run an organization called Empower Work that provides an SMS hotline for people facing a tough work situation. And one of the things that we found really valuable is connecting with another human and talking through what they've experienced in their workplace. So whether that's like, what's normal? Is this aberrant? Is this off? That we're in such an information overload that sometimes having that processing space with someone that's third party can be really transformative.
Indeed. Well said. And I thank you for that call. Let me get some more callers on. We'll go to Woodacre next and welcome Liz. Liz, good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to say that when I heard the announcement of who was going to be on Forum, I don't know anything about Jenny or her book, or I didn't know. And I thought, oh, my goodness, why do we need a book about how to be quiet or how to be on our own or how to be still? This is ridiculous. But from the little bit that I was able to listen to the show, I have to say I've totally changed my mind, and I can't wait to get my hands on your book, Jenny. So thank you.
Well, thank you for that call. Jenny is smiling, as you might imagine. And here's a listener who writes, one thing that has worked for us is making sure we build walks into regular life to the extent possible, walking the kids to their school a mile away, walking to transit stops, then take transit to work, et cetera. And maybe people can make more of an effort to build those walks into their lives that's otherwise hectic.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although, again, it's like, you know, I address this a little bit at the end of the book. It depends a lot on where you are, right? Like I mentioned, you know, after talking about the benefits of walking and parks, that parks are not evenly distributed throughout cities, right? You find a lot of open space and parks up in the hills that are in more affluent areas than you typically do in lower income areas. So it's another thing that's important to acknowledge. But I do agree that I think for me, the attention economy is also bound up with ideas of almost like an obsessive level of convenience and efficiency, that like everything in one's life should be highly efficient. And if you took that idea to its extreme, you would never leave your apartment, you would do all of your work remotely, and you would have everything delivered to you, and you would never move, right? Like if we really push that to its logical conclusion. And so the things that get lost are things like walking, talking to a human person who is selling you something. If you look up something on Google Maps and you ask, like, how do I get from point A to point B, it's going to tell you the most efficient way to get there. But it's like, what if I have actually 10 extra minutes and I don't want the most efficient way to get there? What if I actually do want to be interrupted by a stranger, you know? And I have this whole section in the middle of the book about, it's sort of like an ode to AC transit, because I often take the bus to my studio, and that it's slow, but it's an important time of the day for me to just sit with the reality of other people on the bus who are not, I have no instrumental relationship to, that, you know, there's nothing that I can get from them. They have not been recommended to me. They are just people with their own realities going to their own destinations. And it's really important for me to just, you know, have a moment with that as often as possible.
I walk, and I find not only that it's good exercise as advertised and as studied by many, but it's also a really good way to think and also to observe. And that's really what you're talking about to a great deal here. And from time to time, be creative. Here's Teresa, who tweets, I grew up with the idea of high constant productivity equals good, and doing nothing or resting equals bad, always looking to the next thing, making it hard to be present. Since life only exists in the present, if I don't change, I will get to the end of my life never having lived at all. Let me bring another caller aboard here, and let's go next to you. Douglas, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Sure. Hi. Thanks, Michael. Listen, the story is really just a perspective story. I was in Africa, in Nairobi, about 15 years ago, about 20 years ago, doing some work with Richard Leakey. And I was sitting on a park bench outside the Nairobi Hilton with a friend that I'd made. His name is Francis. We were there for some time, just talking. And I commented to Francis in kind of an American way, because he brought my attention to it. I said, you know, we've been here for a while. That guy's just down there. And that's kind of sad. And he said, why? He asked me why. And I said, well, you know, he's just sitting there and life is passing him by. Francis laughed literally at me. And he said, you Americans, he said, you really don't get it, do you? And I said, what do you mean, Francis? He said, Douglas, he is sitting on a bench enjoying life as things go by. And it was a real perspective changer for me. And it brought me to kind of a conversation with him about, you know, how we, particularly Americans or Western civilized capitalists, seem to be more interested in being human doings rather than being human beings.
That's nicely said. Douglas, hold on. You dropped a big name there. Richard Leakey. What were you doing working with Richard Leakey? You got me curious.
I apologize. I didn't mean to do it that way.
No,
1992, Richard Leakey, Kuki Gallman. I did some work in the preservation of the African elephant. It was pre-ecotourism, but basically I helped build fences in villages to help villagers take a more friendly approach, not just to tourism dollars, but to the wildlife around them and protecting them.
And man, you're not only a modest man, you're a hero. And thank you for giving us your story there. Appreciate hearing from you. And let's bring another caller. Andreas, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I have a question. I've been really enjoying listening to your show and hearing about the book, and I think it's a really probably a great book and for the individual, but there was one caller who had a comment about asking the author if she had any ideas what could be done more on a larger scale, because I think I'm a dad in San Francisco with two small kids, and there's absolutely no time left in the day, you know, and I'm a healthcare provider. I talk to so many people every day. They all have the same problem. Like in 1935, the average male had 43 hours per day that they could do whatever they want with, you know, and by 1995, that was down to 14. I don't know how many free hours the average American man has today. And when you're raising a family and children, you know, and there's so many changes in culture, like, and then you have all these big companies like Facebook and Google running our lives and running our schedules. Like, what is the bigger answer?
Andreas, you know, you're raising, a very important point. I don't know, Jenny, if you have... it's a tough question, but how do you large scale this is really what he's asking.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's not one that I think I really fully answer in the book, although I kind of gesture in that direction. I will say that that is pretty much precisely the question that I am spending all of my time researching right now, so which may not surprise anyone. But the sort of provisional, you know, thing that I say in the book about that is that, you know, in the same chapter, it's talking about the general strike and how, you know, there's a sort of, we're coming back to that, the individual, hyper-individualized worker for whom time is money. And I think isolation is a really big part of this, not being able to organize with other people who are experiencing the same thing. That in that situation, it's really important for, you know, anyone who does have any kind of margin, whether that's, you know, like a bit of time here or there, or a bit of attention, to, you know, first pull away from the attention economy enough to think about what it would mean to push back on this system overall. Because I agree that that is something that, like, what I'm talking about can only really be done within a certain type of framework, and that framework is increasingly unavailable to a lot of people.
Well, you are raising some very important questions, and I thank you for that, and thank you for spending this time with us. I just want to conclude with some personal experiences of doing nothing since we asked about those. Elizabeth writes, I used to love hanging my baby's diapers on the clothesline, raising my arms above my head outside in the sunshine. Felt like I was dancing. And Ken writes, my boredom is my fly rod. It takes me to those quiet and sometimes roaring rivers, which soothes my soul. I'll be bored to tears again this weekend. Thank you. Thank you, Jenny O'Dell. Good to have you with us. Jenny O'Dell's book, again, is How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. She'll be at Moe's Bookstore in Berkeley on August 6th at 7 o'clock p.m. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Karina Yaffe. Our senior editors, Dan Zoll, and our engineers are Katie McMoran and Danny Bringer. Engagement producers are Amanda Stupai and Ariana Prale, with support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Caroline Smith and Sam Klein-Markman. Executive editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for being with us, and you can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.